Welcome to the History of European Theatre podcast, and thanks for joining me on this journey through millennia of theatrical history. Episode 116, Shakespeare in His Time. One of the original taglines I thought up for this podcast was that it would be much more than just a list of dates and plays. I have to confess that this episode comes the closest I ever have come to breaking that promise and reeling off a list of dates, but I'm going to stick with it because I think putting Shakespeare into the context of his times, both the political, the artistic, and the specifically theatrical times, is a valuable exercise that builds on the scene setting that I presented last episode. So today, I'm going to run through the life and times of William Shakespeare. I'll be avoiding the more speculative elements of what we think we know and try to stick to the better attested facts. But as you will soon hear, there are many dates and events about which we can be less than precise. So, this is my best attempt at putting what we do know into chronological order and keeping it that way as much as possible. I will, of course, be talking about all of the points made here again in detail in the coming episodes. This is just an overview, and it is intentionally at a pretty high level at the moment. There were so many changes in the realms of politics, religion, science, and the arts during Shakespeare's lifetime that what I have included here are inevitably just a few significant markers at a very high level. But I hope they will help to keep you historically orientated for this view of the life and the plays of William Shakespeare. Although the first record of William Shakespeare is from 1564, I'm going to start a few years before that, just for a bit of context. Theatrical records are horribly sparse before the mid-16th century, but there are particular facts that we can pick up which are relevant here. So, for a start, we have the first performance of Gorboduc at the Inns of Court in 1561. As a proto-history play or tragedy, that had been preceded in 1552 or thereabouts by the comedy Ralph Royster Doyster. By the 1560s, Elizabeth had been on the throne for a few years, having ascended in 1558, so things were becoming a little more politically stable in England. But she still had many doubters and factious religious disputes to contend with, as she steered a course between her new national church and the reluctant Catholics. 1564 is, of course, the year William Shakespeare was born. But it's also notable as the year that Christopher Marlowe was born, coincidentally also the year of Galileo's birth, and, surely more significantly for the people at the time, Michelangelo died. Quite a year. William Shakespeare was baptised on the 26th of April, with his date of birth being therefore taken as the 23rd, although there's no documentary proof of this. 1664 was also a year of plague. The year before, about 20,000 people had died of plague in London. That's more than a quarter of the population of the city at the time. The winter that followed was a mild one, which survivors may have thought of as a blessing at the time, but it meant that the fleas that carried the disease didn't die of cold, but hibernated. When they awoke in spring 1664, plague again rapidly spread through the city and then out into the country. By the summer, it had reached Stratford-upon-Avon, some 100 miles distant from the city. 200 residents of the town are recorded as perishing in the pestilence, but luckily the young William survived, perhaps taken into the country with his mother to her relatives until the illness passed. A year later, we have a record of John Shakespeare, William's father and local businessman in Stratford, being made alderman of the town. He was then in his mid-30s and a man on the rise at this point, a successful local businessman who had made a very decent marriage to Mary Arden, daughter of a gentleman farmer who was a member of the minor English gentry. Mary had given birth to two daughters, but both had died before William was born. The following year, another son, Gilbert, was to be born to the family, and another son would follow. In all, John and Mary had 8 children, but only 4 survived to adulthood. Another notable theatrical birth came in 1566 when the Allen family in London welcomed a son, Edward, to add to their brood. Of more national significance was the birth of a royal son to the Stuart monarchs of Scotland, James, who would become the 6th of Scotland and, in time, the 1st of England and a united kingdom. Elizabeth was only in her mid-30s at this point, so concerns about her succession were there, but concerned with marriage possibilities, rather than who might succeed her if she were to die childless. That changed as she aged, and James, as a relation and a Protestant monarch, would become her nominated successor. 1567 saw the opening of a theatre at the Sign of the Red Lion just outside the City of London. James Burbage, a joiner by trade but a player by choice, had an entrepreneurial eye and, we have to assume, must have visited to see what was going on there, as plans for a purpose-built theatre were brewing in his mind. It was a subject he no doubt was thinking on as his son Richard was born that year, he who was to become one of, if not the greatest, player of his time. Politically, all eyes in England were on Scotland. As Mary fought to keep her position as Queen following the murder of her husband Lord Darnley, and growing opposition to her reign. Mary was always a problem for Elizabeth, but seeing the deposing of a queen, her cousin, was something that she also did not like to contemplate because of the implications it held for her. 1568 saw John Shakespeare continuing his rise in Stratford society as he became a bailiff, the highest office for a locally elected official. But soon after, things started to fall apart for him as he was accused of usury. That year was also the year that the one-year-old James was handed the Scottish throne following the deposing of his mother by the Scottish gentry and her flight to England into Elizabeth's care. On a much lighter note, it was also the probable year of the composition of the rustic comedy Gamma Gurton's Needle. In Shakespeare's lifetime, and for years beyond, there was constant religious friction between Catholics and Protestants in the country. 1569 saw a significant uprising amongst the Catholics in England when the Northern Earls raised 700 men in an attempt to depose Elizabeth and put Mary on the throne. The attempt failed, but served as a warning to Elizabeth about the strength of Catholic sympathies in the country, the threat incumbent in Mary's presence, and the delicate nature of her position. The repression of Catholics that followed was one of the reasons given for Elizabeth's excommunication by the Pope in 1570. Things in the country did not improve, and in 1571 there was a Catholic rebellion in Scotland and the Ridolfi plot in England planned for the assassination of Elizabeth. Although there's no evidence for it, 1571 would probably have been the year William started in the local grammar school in Stratford as a beneficiary of the increased access to education for boys. As I've mentioned before, this is an important development in Tudor society, and one we will return to again in the context of Ben Jonson. Speaking of whom, 1572 was the year of his birth. The St. Bartholomew's Day massacre in Paris that August saw the slaughter of French Huguenots by the Catholic forces of the king. After this, Huguenot migration to England picked up significantly. Marlowe would later memorialise his interpretation of these events in his play The Massacre at Paris, and the presence of refugees who settled in London would play a part in the tensions in the city for years to come. In the same year, there's a record of the Earl of Leicester's men playing at Stratford. There was another Stratford theatrical event in 1574 when the Earl of Warwick's men entertained the locals, and again in 1575 when the Queen and her court visited Kenilworth Castle, just 12 miles from Stratford. The theatrical nature of events held there for her visit are quite well documented, and records like this, from a period when we have no details about Shakespeare's childhood, have prompted much speculation about an awestruck young lad, perhaps getting a front row seat thanks to his father's prominent position in local society, and getting a taste for theatre. But they are, sadly, nothing more than speculations. England always felt under threat from the powerful European kingdoms of France and Spain. But troubling news came from further away in 1576, when plague visited Venice. It's estimated that one third of the population died, about 50,000 people. Unusually, the following year saw a return of the plague that was just as bad. Over the full year, about 80,000 people died in Venice. News travelled slowly then, and the English may not have been aware of the problems in Venice for some weeks, or sure how soon they might be visited by the pestilence yet again. It's difficult to imagine how fear of the plague affected people, given that there was little protection from it, bar praying for deliverance, but in this case, London and the country were largely spared from such devastation. Just as well for James Burbage, who opened his theatre in London and, given the state of his finances, needed to get paying audience packed into the wooden playhouse. His venture was a success and kick-started London's love of theatrical mass entertainment. In 1577, we get a sense of the ambitions of empire in England beginning to take hold. Francis Drake departed for Plymouth on his voyage that would eventually see him circumnavigate the globe. There was also the advent of the Great Comet that was seen across parts of Europe and Asia in November. It caused much consternation and differing interpretations amongst the political and religious classes. Closer to home, and much more serious for those involved, was the MacDonald Massacre in Scotland. This is likely the year that William left school, but again, there's no proof of that. The fortunes of his family were in decline, with John getting behind on paying his taxes, which is just the start of his financial problems to come. Significantly for William's later work, Holinshed's Chronicles was published, although it's doubtful that he saw a copy at this point, and it is the revised second edition, published in 1587, that would become a significant source for him. As if concerns about the plague were not enough, 1578 saw an outbreak of sweating sickness. This was to be the last recorded occurrence of the disease, not that that fact would have been any consolation to those suffering from it. You could be struck down with it and dead within 24 hours. The disease is still a mystery, but a reasonable assumption is that it was a virulent form of influenza virus that disappeared as it mutated relatively quickly into a less deadly form. Back in Stratford in 1579, John was forced to mortgage Mary's estates to keep the family afloat. This is perhaps the lowest point for the family, who were by now in a very precarious position socially and financially. It is the period where William may have been contributing to the family finances by working as a tutor locally. Amid concerns about rebellion in Ireland, Elizabeth found something to celebrate in 1580 when Francis Drake returned to England, completing the circumnavigation of the globe. He was knighted the following year in a ceremony on board the ship, the Golden Hind. For many, this symbolises the start of Elizabethan ambitions for empire. In 1582, a marriage licence was issued for William Shakespeare and Anne Hathaway. She was 26, he was 18. The age difference and circumstances of the marriage have been the cause of much speculation and literary embellishment, so we will need to pick over the details that we have, but for the moment, let's say that Anne's age was not so unusually old for marriage at the time, but Shakespeare's was a little young. We certainly can't assume that it was a shotgun wedding, despite Anne's premarital pregnancy. In the theatre, it was the year that is the earliest possible date for Kyd's Spanish Tragedy, although it could have been written as late as 1592. In 1583, William and Anne's first child, Susanna, was baptised. In the theatrical world, Elizabeth ordered the formation of the Queen's Men. As you may remember, the new troupe was formed by raiding players from Leicester's Men and other playing troops, and was almost certainly a ploy in her fight with the Earl, her former favourite, Robert Dudley, who was getting more than a little above himself. Other important news for that year was the arrival of coffee in London for the first time, although, to be fair, that information may not have reached it as far as Stratford. And it was the year that the first British North American colonies were founded. The Elizabethans were going global, and although they would soon discover that the Spanish had just been very lucky discovering as much gold and silver as they did in the New World, migration continued, driven by religion and poverty. But much that was of a real concern for most was closer to home. In 1584, a somewhat cowed Robert Dudley was in Vissingen with the English fleet and army, including Will Kemp for his entertainment, fighting a war in support of the continental Protestants and with an eye on maintaining the important English wool trade, the bedrock of the English trading economy since medieval times. William and Anne's family expanded in 1585 with the birth of twins, Hamnet and Judith. It was also the year that Walter Raleigh first brought tobacco to England. By 1586, John Shakespeare's financial problems were coming to a head, and he was removed from the Board of Aldermen in Stratford. 1587 saw tricky times in England. Mary, Queen of Scots, was executed, and the threat from Spain seemed very real. Francis Drake had a success with his raid on Cadiz, where he famously singed the King of Spain's beard. But that did little to reduce the Spanish threat, however much the story of his derring do raised the mood of the population. In the same year, Christopher Marlowe was granted his undergraduate degree from Cambridge University following the intervention of the Privy Council, who seemed to acknowledge service he had done for the country abroad during breaks in his time at university. We can assume he travelled directly to London, with the manuscript of a draft of the first part of Tamburlaine safely stashed amongst his meagre possessions. The first recorded performance of his play was in that year. For the English, 1588 was a year dominated by the threat from Spain, until late in the year when the Spanish Armada was defeated, or rather, when it failed to land in England and was mostly destroyed in bad weather on its return journey around the country. In 1589, Marlowe's Dr. Faustus was probably performed for the first time. It's generally accepted that Shakespeare made his way to London at about this time, probably as a member of an acting troupe, but also perhaps working for his father, promoting his glove-making business. The first evidence of his writing plays comes in 1592, so now we can get into the chronology of his plays. In March that year, Philip Henslowe records a performance of Henry VI at the Rose Theatre, meaning that it must have been written in 1591. Although Henslowe's note is not expansive, there are good arguments for this being the history play by Shakespeare. Henry VI Part 2 and Part 3 probably followed quickly on the success of the earlier play, but firm evidence for it doesn't come until the quarto publication in 1594. Nevertheless, Green's Upstart Crow comment seems to include a quote and a parodied line from the later play, so putting the date for all the parts back to 1591 or 1592 is reasonable. Green died that year, shortly after writing that comment, which was to make him more famous to the future than his plays and pamphlets ever would. Richard III, another history play but occasionally referred to as a tragedy, is thought to have been written sometime between 1592 and 1594. Scholars see the influence of the play in Marlowe's Edward II, and he died in 1594, but it remains a tricky play to date. The Taming of the Shrew is another play where dating is difficult, but it's thought to be from that period. In fact, in this case, dating is a particularly difficult issue, so there will be more on that another time, but of course the dating is surely not the most difficult thing about that play for us today. Shakespeare's poem, Venus and Adonis, was published in 1593 and, as far as we know, was his first published work. Theatres were again closed to limit the spread of the plague, so the poem was probably what we would now think of as Will's lockdown project. It was immediately popular and remained so, being reprinted 15 times before 1640. Titus Andronicus is probably a collaboration with another playwright, maybe George Peele, but is often seen at Shakespeare's first proper attempt at a tragedy and can be confidently dated at no later than 1594 when Philip Henslowe records a performance with the annotation NE, which is accepted to mean new or premier performance. Suggestions remain that it was actually written much earlier and maybe as early as the very late 1580s. And what else is going on in the London theatre world while the fledgling playwright is finding his feet? Well, 1593 saw Kyd and Marlowe embroiled in accusations of heresy, with Marlowe's death coming the following May. These were difficult times in the London theatrical circles. In 1594, the Lord Chamberlain's men were formed and became the principal but not exclusive company for court entertainments, taking over from the Queen's men. They would dominate the stage for the next decade or so, with only the Admiral's men seen to be close rivals. It was also probably the year that saw the first performance of Marlowe's Dr. Faustus. The following year brought the opening of the Swan Theatre and Shakespeare's first play publication, a shortened version of Henry VI in a quarto edition. Two Gentlemen of Verona is another early play that's very difficult to date. It's mentioned by Francis Mears in his 1598 list as an example of why Shakespeare is best for comedy. But it's thought to have been much earlier than that. There have been good arguments for it being Shakespeare's earliest work, even as early as 1589. But as it seems to borrow from a John Lyly play, Midas, which can't have been written earlier than late 1589, Two Gentlemen of Verona is usually pushed back to 1591 or 1592, but with a huge question mark over the date. We seem to be on much firmer ground with The Comedy of Errors, which was performed at Gray's Inn for Christmas 1594. But there are some references in the play to the French Wars of Succession, which, if they were topical, mean that the writing of the play could be dated anywhere between 1589 and 1595. Love's Labour's Lost is thought to have been written in 1594 or 1595. A 1598 manuscript of the play includes a note that the version was presented before Her Highness this last Christmas. A quarto edition published the same year states that the text is newly corrected and augmented by W. Shakespeare, perhaps meaning that it is a revised version of an earlier play. A Midsummer Night's Dream poses more dating problems. A reference in the text to flooded farmland causing crop failure, and another to courtiers being afraid of a strange lion, which might allude to an incident in Scotland, both suggest a date of 1594, but it could be a year or two later. Romeo and Juliet is placed at about the same time, but perhaps as early as 1591. The consensus settles on about 1595. The conjecture is based on references in the text to earthquakes and astrological events, but interpreting exactly which events are being referenced is not easy. Whatever the case, it's an early tragedy following on from a slew of comedies. Richard II has a first recorded performance in December 1595 and is confidently dated to that year. By 1601, it is described as old and out of use as part of the defence of the players when their performance of it became caught up in the Essex Rebellion. 1596 saw famine across Europe and food riots in England, but for Shakespeare it was, to say the least, a mixed year. His son Hamnet died in August that year, aged 11. But for the time, it wasn't unusual. About a third of children died before the age of 10. That William's long-standing efforts to get a coat of arms granted for his father finally paid off the same year must have been bittersweet for the family. The granting of the coat of arms established both father and sons as gentlemen. There were only 45 gentlemen in Stratford out of a population of about 2,200. 17 of these were tradesmen who had earned the position, like John. Quite a change of fortune, but it is likely that the reward was mostly thanks to his son's efforts and perhaps his rising popularity and success. King John, like many other plays, wasn't printed until its inclusion in the First Folio, and its first recorded performance isn't until 1737. But it is usually ascribed to between 1587, the year of publication of the second edition of Holinshed's Chronicles, which are a major source for the play, and 1598, when it is mentioned in the list by Francis Mears. Some linguistic studies put the date at the end of that range, perhaps 1596. The Merchant of Venice is another play mentioned by Mears in 1598, and it was registered for publication in that year too, so a date of 1596 or 1597 is thought reasonable. In the text, there's a reference to a ship called Andrew, which is thought to refer to a ship that was captured at Cadiz, which is consistent with this time frame. Returning to the history play genre, 1597 is thought to be the most likely date for Henry IV Part 1. Part 2 followed the same year, or the next, no doubt capitalising on the success of the first part. There's a manuscript copy of a single version of the play, which opens the possibility that it was originally a single play that was expanded into two parts. However, it's thought more likely that this manuscript represents the condensing of two parts into one for the purposes of a private or perhaps an amateur performance. It was in that summer that The Isle of Dogs by Thomas Nash and Ben Jonson was performed at the Swan Theatre. As you've heard previously, the authorities took such offence to it that all the theatres were closed for months in a governmental crackdown that also suggested they should be torn down. Cooler heads prevailed, but Ben Jonson and two other players in the company were imprisoned for weeks, and Nash fled the capital. 1597 is also the year that we get solid evidence for Shakespeare's growing wealth. In that year, he purchased New Place, a medieval timber and brick building that we very likely extended and improved to bring it up to date. The purchase price was £120, no small investment for the time. In 1598, he is mentioned as one of the chief hoarders of malt and corn in Stratford. This was in an official survey undertaken because there was a grain shortage in the country. Again, it suggests wealth and perhaps other trading activities in which he invested his profits from the theatre. 1598 was the year for Much Ado About Nothing, probably for the seasonal entertainments late in the year. The dating is confident because the part of Dogberry is clearly written for Will Kemp, who left the Lord Chamberlain's men in 1599. That year saw Henry V maybe open the Globe Theatre. References to the situation in Ireland seem to point to expectations about the Essex expedition of 1599 being in the air in London, and Falstaff's omission from the play following the departure of Will Kemp, possibly amid some bad feeling between the players, all seem to support this dating. As You Like It is also dated to late 1599, as is Julius Caesar, the latter being recorded as being seen at the Globe by the Swiss visitor Thomas Platter. Also, neither are mentioned in the Francis Mears list for comedy or tragedy, and surely they would have been if they had been well known in 1598. Hamlet is dated to 1600, although it wasn't published until 1602. Allusions to Julius Caesar in the play certainly place it after 1599. The Merry Wives of Windsor is harder to date. Textual references to the Order of the Garter, the senior rank of English knighthood, suggest that it could be as early as 1597, but other suggestions are as late as 1601. Twelfth Night is probably from the same year, and certainly not earlier than 1599, which was the year of the aforementioned Essex Revolt, and also the year Thomas Nash died. Troilus and Cressida was first performed in 1601 or 1602, and 1601 was the year John Shakespeare died in September. William's relationship with his father remains a point of much speculation and few facts. 1603 saw the death of Elizabeth and the accession of James to the throne. An outbreak of plague delayed his entry into London and again decimated the population of the capital, but once he had established his court, he reinvented the Lord Chamberlain's men and licensed them as the King's men. They, and the Globe Theatre, were now firmly established as the centre of theatrical life in the capital and the country, with Shakespeare as their resident playwright. Othello was played at court in November 1604, although some argue for a slightly earlier date. Measure for Measure formed part of the court entertainments that Christmas and was probably written earlier that year. There is no documentary evidence for when All's Well That Ends Well was written, but scholars put it between 1603 and 1606 on stylistic grounds. Similarly, Timon of Athens is given the same range of dates, but was probably not performed until 1606. And in other matters, 1605 is a significant year. There was the gunpowder plot in England that failed to unseat James. Johnson and Chapman were imprisoned for the sedition detected in their play Eastward Ho, and, of international literary importance, Cervantes published Don Quixote. At the same time, Shakespeare was writing King Lear, which was first performed at court in December 1606. There are references in the text to astronomical events that happened in late 1605, backing up that dating. 1606 also saw Macbeth, clearly a Jacobean play given its Scottish setting and the compliments in the text to King James. Antony and Cleopatra may have been the same year as well, or perhaps 1607. 1608 was the year for Coriolanus and Pericles, but also the year that William's mother, Mary, died. There's then a gap to Cymbeline in 1610. In the intervening year, the King's men bought the Blackfriars Theatre, and there was a long period of theatre closures until spring 1610 to guard once again against the spread of the plague. In 1609, a collection of Shakespeare sonnets was published in quarto edition. It's not clear if Shakespeare authorised the edition or not, but the contents and the possible identity of the subjects of the emotions expressed in the poems have been another point of Shakespearean speculation. A Winter's Tale was first performed at the Globe in May 1611 with The Tempest at court in November the same year. Henry VIII is confidently dated to 1613 because it was during a performance of the play that the Globe was burnt to the ground after the thatch roof caught fire, a disaster caused by the use of cannons as sound effects. No lives were lost, but despite the quick rebuilding of the theatre the following year, the blow to Shakespeare and his fellow sharers is speculated as being significant, as it more or less marks the end of Shakespeare's career. After this, he appears to have retired to Stratford. We're just left with Two Noble Kinsmen, co-written with John Fletcher, in, we assume, 1614, where the Our Loss referred to in the prologue is taken to mean the original Globe Theatre. There is also, or rather, there was also, Cardonio, a lost play, again co-written with Fletcher. Records show that it was performed in 1613. William died on the 23rd of April, 1616, very likely exactly on his 52nd birthday. There's no contemporary record of his cause of death, but 50 years later, a local parish priest recorded that it was due to a fever contracted after a night of heavy drinking, with his friends Ben Jonson and Michael Drayton, who had come to visit. All we can say is that it's not an implausible story. His last will was written shortly before, where he says he considers himself to be in good health. So sorry if that was all a bit listy and a lot of dates. I promise I won't do that to you again. And of course, we will be going over all of this in more detail in the coming weeks and months, so don't worry if it got a bit much. Let me summarise what I think should be the main takeaway from this. Clearly, precise dating of Shakespeare's plays is very difficult. You might think a year or two either way might not make too much difference, but as you've heard, the uncertainties are rather more significant than that in some cases. And all in all, this does mean that drawing any detailed conclusions about Shakespeare's progression as a playwright and a poet is quite difficult. It means we have to settle for the rather generic statements about early, middle and late periods. To fill the gaps left relating to the plays and his life, the most minute details have been heavily scrutinised, picked over, interpreted and extrapolated upon for many years. Some that is very valid and sensibly thought through, some not so. We have to admit that it is exactly the lack of detail in both departments that has allowed the mythology around Shakespeare to grow into an industry in itself. This is to take nothing away from Shakespeare's achievements as a playwright. His best plays do stand well above those of his contemporaries, and even his weaker efforts stand up well in the pack. Exactly why that is the case is something that I hope will emerge as I look at the plays in detail. Shakespeare wasn't working at the very beginning of the Elizabethan public theatre. We have to go back a decade or so for that and look at the likes of Greene and Kidd, Nash and Marlowe. They had established a form that he took on and developed to new heights. The question of how much this was due to his personal abilities, many would say his personal genius, and how much he was standing on the shoulders of giants is another difficult point to judge. But I think we do need to recognise that Shakespeare was in the right place at the right time for his talent to flourish, because he also had other playwrights to work around and with, actors who had developed a craft and could shine in his plays, theatre managers who funded his work and stood up for the art of playing and the place of theatre in society when it was needed, and worked at a time when the grip of the church and, to an extent at times, that of central government was beginning to be loosened in some respects. Just a little. Most of all, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that Shakespeare, like most other playwrights, was a man of his times, and used his plays to comment on them. Getting into that sort of detail should give us a better understanding and more enjoyment of his work. Next time, I'll make a start on the biography of Shakespeare and his family as I dig into what we know and what we don't know about William of Stratford. In the meantime, please join the Facebook page or group, or find the podcast on Instagram or X, just to keep up to date with new episodes and other theatre-related stuff. If you do feel able to help out with the costs of running the podcast, then please head over to Patreon, where you will find additional content for a small monthly fee or a one-off donation. You can find details of way to support the podcast at the website, which is www.thehistoryofeuropeantheatre.com. I look forward to your company next time, but if you have any comments or concerns in the meantime, you can contact me by email at thoetp@gmail.com or via X @thoetp.